Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Erica Roebuck, who is the national best-selling author of historical fiction, including Sisters of Night and Fog, The Invisible Woman, and Hemingway's Girl. Her articles have appeared in Writer Unboxed, Crime Reads, and Writer's Digest, and she's been named a Maryland Writers Association Notable Writer of 2024. A boating enthusiast, amateur historian, and teacher, she resides in Annapolis with her husband and three sons. And the book that we are talking about today, which is coming out in August, is The Last Assignment. Welcome to Writers' Voices.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be with you.
So the Last Assignment is based on a real person, right?
Yes.
Have all of your historical fiction novels been based on real people?
Aside from my first self-published novel, everything with a major publisher has been has had real characters from history. And it slowly has become where they were the side characters to then they became the focus with a fictional character. And now it's really become more biofiction, where I really try not to fictionalize characters unless absolutely necessary.
And who is The Last Assignment about?
It's about a dynamite, intrepid combat correspondent named Georgette Dickey Chappelle, who covered 7 major conflicts. And she's the kind of woman you come across and you say, how have I never heard of her before?
Exactly. That was just what I was going to ask you. How have I never heard of her before? And how?
That's my specialty. That's who I like to find.
And how did you find her?
I found her, my father-in-law served in Vietnam, and I've always had an interest in war history. My grandfather, I was very close to, my late grandpa, was in the Navy, and we used to watch Victory at Sea movies together. It was very unusual, and he had millions of National Geographics. So I was very interested in travel and the military, and I lived close to the Naval Academy. But with Dickie, I had happened across a photograph book of Vietnam War photographers and found one of her photographs. And I wanted to know more about the woman behind the camera. And it just led me down a rabbit hole. And again, I get to the end of it and I say, how have I never heard of her before? Which gave me a real opportunity with the novel.
Absolutely. So give us a little bit of sort of in a nutshell, who Dickey Chappelle was and what she's known for.
Well, Dickie vexed her mother from the very beginning. She was not the proper daughter her mother wanted. She used to go with her dad to construction sites and walk across high beams, and she wanted to be a pilot. But she had terrible eyesight, and she almost killed her brother a few times on landing. So she decided, if I can't be a pilot, I will write about pilots. And she worked for various publicity agencies, but really became enamored with the American fighting man. She fell in love with the Marines. They fell in love with her. And she decided, if I can't fly the plane, I'll just jump out of it into combat with them. And she did. And so and she did this not only with U.S. Special Forces, Marines, but she also did it with revolutionary groups. We'll find her in Cuba. There were certain conflicts I didn't even have time to cover, but she wanted to be the eyes and ears for the world of what was going on. And she realized at some point that it was an unusual calling, that a lot of people didn't want that kind of life, and she craved it. And so she threw herself headfirst into it. And she was just a fascinating character.
And her career spanned from World War II to Vietnam.
It did. She started with World War II. Her husband at the time was a press photographer, combat correspondent, and taught her everything she knew about photography because she had already enjoyed journalism. But then she was sent to Iwo Jima and was one of the first women, if not the first woman, on Iwo Jima to take pictures. But unfortunately, Dickie was a little reckless. She was a little bit about act first, think later, don't ask permission, ask for forgiveness. And she ended up getting brought to the brig by the U.S. Armed Forces because she disobeyed orders. She went to the forward line in combat to get pictures. And that was a big problem. So she lost her military accreditation. She learned a lot about the chain of command. And over her time of trying to work back to it, she did a lot of soul searching and a lot of learning about herself. When she was able to get that back years later, she was a lot more mature, though still very daring.
One of the things as I was reading The Last Assignment was it's such a reminder of how difficult it was for women to do anything outside of their normal assigned gender roles, basically, in that time period. And I hate to say we seem to be heading back in that direction in some area, in some parts of our country and the world today that are trying to push women back into that. You know, I grew up at a time where, you know, in my childhood, it was pretty, gender roles were pretty prescribed, but by the time I was a young adult, there was a lot more freedom. Was this something that you really, that surprised you, or that you wanted to focus on, is how being a woman made it more challenging for her?
Well, I focused on women in the shadows of history, both literary, war, and intelligence, for most of my career. And I found those stories weren't being told as much until recently, and now it's really exploded. With the declassification of a lot of World War II intelligence files and also from the Great War, we're learning a lot more about how women did contribute. So I kind of make it my mission to find them and to elevate and sort of give them a new chance to come onto the scene. What does consistently surprise me, though, especially with Dickie Chappelle, is she really didn't take no for an answer. And so when she would go places that she wasn't wanted, she would go somewhere else until she found her people. She had a lot of resilience that way. She definitely was hurt. She got hurt quite a bit. Some of the male press correspondents were not kind to her. But she also had the wisdom to understand that they were embarrassed because they weren't as willing to go. So literally jump out of a helicopter into conflict with fighting men. They would stay at the hotel bar and get the report later from the soldiers. She wanted to be right next to them. And because of that, she really earned their trust, the soldiers, their love, their protection, and became kind of a den mother to them. So it was interesting to see her find where she could fit in, but she definitely experienced a lot of pushback. But some of the other women I found, I had just written a book about codebreakers in the Coast Guard during Prohibition, and there were so many women in power positions. I like these women that keep going, and they, when they find a calling, they see it through. And that's, it's a real joy for me to write about that.
Wow. Throughout the book, you kind of refer to, or Dickie thinks back on her childhood and being bullied and so forth. You don't really go too much into what happened. The book starts later in her life. So what was it that... what do you think in her childhood really made her develop this resilience?
Well, she was an overweight little girl, and her mother and everybody used to tell her all the time about how chubby she was. And she had huge glasses because she couldn't see very well. And she was not a traditional feminine little girl. She wanted to be with the boys, climbing trees and, again, at construction sites. Every day on the way to school, when she passed the flag, she would stop and salute it. She was really her own person, and she marched to the beat of her own drum. And like, you know, she went on a date one time, and she spent the whole time looking at the motor of the car with the boy. And he made fun of her about it, but then he kind of became friends with her. So she was always doing her own thing. She was one of the first women to get into MIT, got a lot of pushback there. And hanging around pilot yards, and some people accepted her and some didn't. But she really had almost a childlike capacity to take everything in stride. She was bullied. It did hurt her. It hurt her most when it came from her own family members, because she was very often antagonized by them. But it made her a very strong person, and she knew herself so thoroughly that she was able to keep going in spite of that. And I think that's what gave her the grit she needed to go to become a combat correspondent.
And she did have some very supportive family members too, as well.
She did. I enjoyed very much exploring her relationship with her aunts. Neither of them had children. Both were delighted by her. They were very, very supportive of her and not antagonistic. One, fretted and worried over her, but in a loving way. And also her dad. Her dad really, really enjoyed her. And then when he died, it pulled the rug out from under her. So she did have a lot of support, and certainly I would say more support than bullying.
And her aunt Georgie, or mm-hmm. she was non-traditional too.
Yes, she was a poet, and she ended up getting divorced at a time when that was absolutely unheard of, and really marched to the beat of her own drum and encouraged Dickie to do the same.
You never know what influence you might have just by doing your own thing, you know,
mm-hmm.
and encouraging somebody else to do their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a little bit about how you researched her life.
Well, there's a treasure trove at the University of Madison, Wisconsin. They have a ton online from Dickie's files. So before one of her last, we'll call it deployments, which she would call it, to Vietnam, she boxed up a lot of her ephemera, and she had so much from all of her travels through her life. She gave some to her agent, she gave some to the Historical Society, and kept the rest in boxes in her apartment to be able to give to them. And all of that is there. Most of it is accessible online, and the researchers there were extremely helpful to me. I would be able to say, I need this letter from this time period. And they were able to direct me to it. So I was able to do a lot with them through primary source material. Also, her photograph archive is there, and that's accessible to everyone. If you go on the Wisconsin Historical Society, you can search by year, by conflict, photos that Dickie took, photos of Dickie. It's an absolute treasure. And then she had written a memoir, What's a Woman Doing Here? And so you get to hear her voice in that. And that was a huge, huge piece for me. There was a biography written many, many years ago that I had my hands on when I was drafting the book. And then a new biography came out a couple of years ago by a woman named Larissa Reinhart, maybe just last year. And it's fantastic. It's called First to the Front. And I was in the editing stage then, and I actually reached out to Larissa and was able to fact check some through that because she had found new source material. So it's really just, and Reader's Digest, National Geographic, Dickie had so much out there, so many articles that I was able to access all of it. And that really, getting her voice in her writing, she was such a beautiful writer. I have multiple copies of articles she wrote all over my house. I keep ordering off of Etsy. You know, somebody cleans out their basement, they find Reader's Digest, and I'm there. So, it's so great to have all these resources at my fingertips. And all of it comes together. And then I have to decide on a timeline for the book, which wars I'm going to cover, because I certainly can't do 7. I'm not a biographer. But really, by then, I know her and I know the themes that I want to find. And then the story rises.
Did you know that someone was working on a biography of her when you started writing?
No, it's just this incredible phenomenon. I've experienced it over and over. Some people refer to it as the collective unconscious. When I was writing about Zelda Fitzgerald, there was nothing about her, but some old biographies. And then all of a sudden, there was a new biography. There were three other novels. The Gatsby movie came out all at the same time. The same thing happened when I was writing about World War II by Virginia Hall. There was nothing about her, but an older biography. And then I met with her niece. And then all of a sudden, there's a movie on Netflix that features her. There's a phenomenal biography that comes out, A Woman of No Importance. There were multiple novels, including for young adults and different age groups and styles. So it's like when these people, I feel like when their story wants to be told, they find anybody who will tell it in any way, and it all rises at the same time.
You're so it's yeah, great. Plugging into some collective consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah, it's wild.
I often think, and you know, this is sort of silly, but that ideas like this are really, they're floating around in the ether, and so yes. It's not surprising that more than one person grabs onto them at a time.
Yeah, I think in Elizabeth Gilbert's book, Big Magic, she talks about a phenomenon where she had this idea for this story, and it was a jungle, and it was South America, and it was all this. And she was talking to her friend, the writer Ann Patchett, who had the same idea. And wrote it in a very different way. But sometimes I really do feel like it's almost like you're finding a radio frequency. Yes. And you don't even have to fear it coming out at the same time, because it all comes across in such a different way. It's like different facets of a jewel.
Right, right. And there's, I think a lot of times writers and who talk about characters just sort of showing up to them.
Yes. You know, they,
or a songwriter where a lyric or a melody just sort of pops into their head. And yes. So maybe that's, and it does often seem like it's happening, the same thing is happening in multiple, to multiple people at the same mm-hmm. time. But
yes,
your interpretation of it, your voice is going to be different than somebody else's.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So let's go back. You mentioned that you had to decide which conflicts to focus on. And you chose not really to focus on World War II, other than in sort of retrospect. You know, she mm-hmm. it gets mentioned, but you're not, but it's not one of the, it's not in the time period that the book is set in. And I'm yes. curious about why you decided that.
Well, I'd written two novels about women in resistance and spying in World War II. And just emotionally, I needed some space from that. It was really hard. The second novel, Sister of Night and Fog, went into Ravensbrück concentration camp for women. And it really puts you through the ringer. And the research you do and the things you have to learn are so heavy. I felt like two World War II books was enough. And it was time for something new. And I was very interested in the Hungarian Revolution. My husband has some family members who were Hungarian. The Cuban Revolution, I have been obsessed with Cuba since Hemingway's Girl. I don't know why I'm completely obsessed with it. And also Vietnam with my father-in-law's connection. And those three seemed, I wanted to learn more about them. And once I started to go deeper into them, saw the connections in what Dickey was doing and in what the United States was trying to accomplish, what revolutionaries were trying to accomplish, how it all went wrong. It all ended up really working together very well.
It's interesting because communism is kind of a common thread in
yes.
these three. And so Dickey became quite anti-communist.
Yes.
But not in a McCarthyist way.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes. She experienced a communist prison. And as she mentions in the book, that'll turn you against it. But what she was really seeing was communism, like fascism, like any kind of totalitarian dictator government is extremely dangerous. And really, some of the research I was doing at the time was so interesting, because if you imagine a pendulum swinging from the far left to the far right, you notice they sort of meet in the middle. And when you get extremism, it's so dangerous. And what she experienced at the time was this rise in communism and on all these different fronts in the world. And see, people sort of throw terms around now, but she was seeing truly what a communist government was and a communist prison and what they were trying to do. I think nowadays we sort of throw it around without a full understanding, but she was seeing exactly what was going on.
Well, it's interesting that in, like in Hungary, they went from fascism to communism.
Yes.
And now back to fascism.
so the pendulum doesn't stop in the middle.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you have something go far out in one way, then the resistance to it ends up drawing far into the other direction. So there needs to be some centrality.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's all just calmed down.
And in Cuba, she started out being a fan of Fidel Castro. He was not communist. How do you think he ended up being a communist dictator instead of the man of the people that he started out with?
Yeah, he had tremendous, tremendous support from within Cuba, from the United States. You know, it was the David and Goliath. The government was extremely corrupt. And he really was talking about freedom and democracy and reinstating the Constitution of 1940. And he had all these great ideals. But the people he put around him very quickly grew like a forest fire. And as time went on, the more people started to, the closer he got to power. And then finally, when he got the taste of absolute power, we know the old saying, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And then he wanted to keep it. And he became like many of the governments of the time who called themselves a government of the people. But he ended up with, you know, 18 houses, multiple yachts, a bunch of different women, just the excess of everything that comes from it. And everything got very corrupted very quickly. And anyone who tried to resist was considered against the revolution. So they were silenced. So he took over the press. He shut down all of the newspapers that weren't totally supportive of everything and everyone he did. So it happened very quickly. And it, there is some debate about whether he was a communist to start, because he declared that he was since his guerrilla days when it came down to it. But he also declared many things that weren't necessarily true. But it was true that very quickly it started with the executions that he would televise and put in stadiums. The bloodlust, and it went downhill really quickly from there.
Wow. Wow. So did you go to any of the places that Dickey went to as part of your research?
No, I was not able to. I just had to interview people. I had to go there on YouTube. I've been invited through the Hemingway Society to go to Cuba, but I have, I'm not able to do that. Just through various intelligence information. It's not really a safe place. And embedded within the society are still a lot of structures that, I guess, from a United States perspective, I just couldn't live with going there. But I would love to go there. I love the place. I love the people. I'm fascinated with history. And I have so many friends who are Cuban. And someday I hope that without, you know, just that everything is able to get to where the revolution said it was going to go to and not to be so corrupted. Because, of course, the government is one thing, but the people are another, living in such poverty and degradation all these years later. So it's very sad.
Yeah. Who is the focal point of Hemingway's girl?
Well, that was set during his second marriage in Key West. I'd visited the house there when we were visiting family in the area. And just became very enamored with the time and the place and the way that people lived there. This was set in the 30s, and I was just, I was captivated. And so it ended up being during his second marriage. And the woman that I wrote about was a fictional housekeeper, kind of like in Gatsby, where you have this reliable narrator telling you what's going on with the people. That was the way that I chose to tell what was going on with Hemingway in his life.
I've always found Hemingway's kind of personal relationships to be fascinating. You know, I love the Paris wife.
Oh, so beautiful.
And, of course, the Paris wife was Hadley, which is my last name. So, And there was a line in, I think, in The Movable Feast that to me was one of the, where he's writing about her.
Yes.
Do you know which line I'm talking about?
Yes.
Where he says, "I wish I had died before I loved anyone but her."
Yes. Yes. That's his redemption to me. That's one of the last things he wrote. And he was a difficult man. But nobody hated his decision-making more than himself. And when he got to that place in his life, I think he really, the shame of it all was part of what destroyed him. And when he wrote the end of it, he kept saying, "I don't even know if I have a heart. If I have a heart, I wouldn't have done this to the people who were good." And, you know, he was longing to go back to those days. He was poor, but it was simpler. And then he had this beautiful marriage and child. So, yeah, that for me redeems him, is that he is self-reflective, because he was a tough guy.
Yeah.
He was a tough guy.
The thing that I love about that line, which it's kind of hard to explain, but it's like he's not denying that he loved these other women.
Yeah.
But he's just wishing that he hadn't, I guess.
Yeah. That he could have maintained.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Erica, why don't you read a little bit from The Last Assignment for us?
I will do so. And this will be, this is the introduction. I won't call it a prologue, but it really sets up the book. It is told with three conflicts. So it's quite a lot to take on, and this encapsulates everything. We meet Dickie in October of 1965 in her home of Madison, Wisconsin. Combat boots with the soil of four continents in their treads pound over the tree-lined walkways of the University of Wisconsin, Madison. Breath coming fast, arms aching with effort, thighs burning, knee protesting, the war correspondent races toward the stairs of the building, housing the Wisconsin Historical Society. Crisp wind rushing off Lake Mendota fills her lungs, and the thrill of beating her little nephew and niece, 7 and 5 respectively, puffs her ego, making her euphoric. Georgette Dickie Meyer-Chapelle takes the lead, she yells over her shoulder like a racehorse announcer. 46 years old, combat fatigue, fake knees, smoker's lungs and all, she triumphs over youth. She laughs in the face of it. Over the crunch of the first fallen leaves, Dickie hears the shrieks of the children close behind her, followed by the laughter of her brother. Though her arms are laden with a box of files and her camera-filled field pack bangs against her back, she pulls farther ahead of Hans and Martha. Students part on the walkway before them, faces an equal distribution of amusement and disapproval. The kids grow hysterical, clearly unable to believe their aunt is going to beat them in a foot race while carrying a 10-pound box. At the Grand Columned Historical Society building, Dickie takes the stairs two at a time, smashes into the wooden doors with the box, sets it on the landing, and jumps up and down, whooping with joy. Once the kids touch the door, she lifts Martha and swings her around, eliciting giggles. Dickie places her niece on the stairs, ruffles Hans's hair, looks up past the oak tree leaves golden against the bright blue sky, and takes a deep breath. Robert walks up behind them, the very picture of the dignified Army veteran turned professor, and shakes his head. He's a geology instructor at the university, and his wife Marion got her PhD in comparative physiology here while the kids babbled in playpens in her office. The campus is a second home to them and just blocks from their real home. Still got it, Robert says. No training like Marine training, Dickie replies. Dickie picks up the file box and they proceed inside. Walking through the neoclassical building, inspired by the Place de la Concorde's colonnades, makes Dickie draw up her shoulders, a surge of pride pulsing through her. The face of the undergraduate at work study in the information desk brightens when she sees Dickie and her entourage coming toward her. The young woman hurries out from behind the desk to help. Dickie has been in contact with the Wisconsin Historical Society for months about donating her many boxes of files, photographs, journals, and news clippings to an archive under her well-known name. Her Manhattan apartment can no longer hold the files, and Dickie has felt an urge to clean out and to nest, almost the way a pregnant woman does before the birth of her child. No need, says Dickie. Just direct me. Through those doors, says the young woman. Dickie takes the box to a conference room and places it on the table. Her brother, his children, and the young woman follow. My photo agent will send the rest, says Dickie. I wanted to see to these boxes myself. After Dickie discusses a few more logistics with the young woman, she leaves them. Dickie turns to see Hans and Martha poking through the boxes. Hans lifts a photograph out of one that brings a smile to Dickie's face. Who's this? Asks Hans. Father Hua, the priest soldier I told you about. The one who lives in Vietnam? Yes. The one who's saving that village you love? The one who's trying, Dickie says. Who tried, she thinks, her smile evaporating. Why are you bringing all this here? Asks Martha. I've been wondering the same thing, says Robert. I told you, says Dickie. I'm donating my papers so future war correspondents have a roadmap, so researchers can see how 20th century history unfolded from the front lines. Isn't this a little premature, says Robert? This is the kind of archive people leave in wills. Dickie and Robert stare across the table at each other for a long moment. Hans pulls a book from the box. It's a well-worn copy of James Michener's novel, The Bridge at Andau. There's a bookmark, and Hans opens up to the page it holds. It's signed to you, says Hans. Yes, by my old friend Jim, who wrote it. What's the book about? Remember when I told you about the Hungarian Revolution, she asks. And the prison, Hans asks, eyes wide. Yes, all that. The book is about the revolution, and I'm in it. Wow, he says, his voice a whisper. Martha pulls out a gold medal. What's this? She asks. Dickie sees the award Fidel Castro gave her for being a friend of Cuba, reporting on the Cuban Revolution. Her arms have fresh scars from the boat explosion just months ago she got with anti-Castro guerrillas. The halls of her memory echo with Fidel's warning that if she ever returns to Cuba, she had better do so with the Marines because she'll need protecting. He once told her when she portrayed him favorably that she had tiger blood in her veins. It's an award from an old friend turned enemy, says Dickie. from Cuba. Weren't you kicked out of there? Asks Hans, like Hungary. Yes, I'm not allowed back in either country. I'm trying to behave better in Vietnam, but my odds aren't looking good. Losing interest in the ephemera from Aunt Dickie's world travels, the kids chase each other around the table. Robert sends them outside to play. Dickie follows, but Robert touches her arm, stopping her. He stares at her, searching her face. She finds she cannot look him in the eye. She turns away, and they walk out together to fetch the rest of the boxes from his car. Outside the building, they stand at the top of the stairs, looking out over the campus, warm and saturated with autumn colors. Though it's tranquil now, protests over American involvement in Vietnam keep erupting. A gust of wind rattles through the trees, dislodging a wrinkled brown leaf. It floats to the ground to rest in the yellowing grass. You're not coming back, are you? Robert asks. I don't think so. Dickie, he chokes on her name. It's not like that, she says. I mean, I don't think I'm going to die. Beg your pardon, sis, but you're getting too old for this. Did you not just see me beat your children in a foot race while carrying a box? I don't mean only physically. Seven conflicts, Dickie. Seven wars. One is too much for most people. You keep going back into the belly of the beast. And we all know you act first, think second. You look up to soldiers like we're heroes. We're just men, Dickie. Men who don't always make the right decisions. Sometimes I wonder if you're addicted to conflict. Dickie's skin grows hot. She feels her tongue ready to lash out at Robert. However, the gentle face of Father Waugh appears in her mind. She thinks of how he tries to win the hearts and minds of his enemies rather than destroy them. She pulls a cigarette out of her pocket and offers one to Robert, which he declines. She takes a few long draws to steady herself. When I said I'm not coming back, she says, I mean Wisconsin will never be my home base. In spite of Aunt Ludie hoping I'll sell my New York apartment and move into the old family house with her. We would all love to have you here, at least as a kind of headquarters before you go on your endless missions. Dickie's anger evaporates. She reaches for Robert's hand. Slug, she says, using her old nickname for her little brother. I love you all so much, but you know my contacts in New York and D.C. are essential to my assignments. And at this point, if I ever set down roots, it would be in South Vietnam. I've fallen in love with it. You'd understand if you could watch the sunset over the rice paddies of the Mekong Delta while the flute plays and the kids fish the canals and the bell in the church rings the all clear every hour, where a lifetime of birth, death, marriage, war, and worship happen in a day and the world is in vivid color. I have this dream that your family will visit me there sometime in the future. Sure, I'll pack the kids in a chopper and we'll all parachute into the village under enemy fire the way Aunt Dickie does. She laughs. If I achieve my life's goal, she says, you'll be able to do just that minus the enemy fire. I thought your life's goal was to always be first. That was a directive by an editor, a code of female combat correspondent conduct, if you will. My new goal is different. Hans and Martha's laughter calls her attention. They glide around the lawn with arms outstretched like airplane wings. Dickie thinks of the endless air shows she dragged Robert to growing up. She thinks of the grainy black and white film of her hero, Admiral Richard Byrd, and his flying missions over Antarctica, and of the rush she gets jumping out of airplanes. Dickie stomps out her cigarette and holds up her hands to frame the scene, thinking of the captions. Children, higher learning, a brisk ball day, a Norman Rockwell vision of freedom and democracy. She pulls her camera out of her field pack, aims, and takes a shot. So what's your goal? Robert asks. My goal is to make the picture to end all wars. And until my last assignment for them, she says, pointing toward the children, I'll work to achieve it.
And that was Erica Roebuck reading from The Last Assignment. Did she obviously didn't get the picture to end all wars, or we wouldn't be dealing with war today. But what was her most famous or most influential photos?
I don't want to reveal too much. I mean, it's not a total secret what happens to a woman who subjects herself to war and war and war. But I would say the most iconic picture that she took was one she won an award for of a Marine in a helicopter with South Vietnamese fighting men. It was the first time our armed forces were ever pictured fighting alongside them in South Vietnam. And there was rumors it was going on, but people didn't know it. So when she made that picture and sent it out, we knew we were in it. And it was a real turning point for better and for worse for the war. She herself was the subject, I think, of one of the most interesting combat photos and moving combat photos I've ever seen. But you'll have to read more to learn what that is.
Now, a lot of her photos were censored.
Yes.
And was this in all of the various conflicts that she was involved in, or some more than others?
Yes, and it frustrated her to no end. But when you are a military photographer, the photographs do belong to the outfit you're with. And from World War II through many of the different conflicts, she was in Laos with special forces. She was censored a lot, and it drove her nuts. But eventually, toward the end of her career, they found out, actually through President Kennedy and dispatches to him, that what she was showing them was valuable intelligence. So she ended up working with military intelligence. And so she would give them her photos and understand they could be useful even if they weren't published. So she had a little bit of both of those, and that was more fulfilling than just having them go in the vault when she understand the value both for the public and for the military. So she was able to make a little more peace with it that way.
Now, she would have been being paid by Reader's Digest or somebody else who sent her there, and if they weren't able to use her photos, how did that affect her? She was a freelancer, so how did that affect her ability to get paid?
It was dramatically affected her ability, and she really didn't live outside of the poverty line for most of her life. She was very much a paycheck to paycheck gal. She was hoping the memoir would help, and she did a lot of speaking tours. So she would speak to a lot of women's clubs, press clubs, and she could make money off of that. So she finally was able to live without being so worried about every paycheck toward the end of her life. But still, she had a one bedroom apartment. She lived very simply. She was quite comfortable with a field pack and a tent. And because she lived simply, it wasn't dramatic.
Wow. You in the part you read, she refers to her friend Jim and James Michener, who I don't, I grew up always hearing about him and his books. I don't know if he's as well known today. What do you think he is, or?
I do, and the reason is because I've been visiting book clubs now for 12 years, and I would say at least half of the book clubs, when we start talking about what we're reading and what we love in historical fiction, somebody always brings up a Michener novel.
Really?
Always. I said 50%. I would say almost 100% of the time. And for I'm from Maryland. For us, his ultimate novel is Chesapeake. And it really is just phenomenal. And I read it next to the bay, a little river that runs into the bay. And so it's really made a mark on me the way like turtles leave a mark in the sand and they come back to it. But yeah, everybody's got like their favorite Michener. And I even wrote a post about it on social media. And everyone had a different book, and they were an evangelist for it. So I do think for people who love historical novels, or even who don't usually read novels, they'll read him.
Because they're all very much based on the history of an area, right? It's like
Yes,
a
very
regional,
meaty history.
So
Yeah, I
you're
would
a
say he was almost Ken Follett. Yeah, like a Ken Follett type writer.
Right. Now your bio refers to you as an amateur historian. Is that what it said? Amateur historian, yes. So did you study history?
No, that's why I feel like I have to call myself an amateur. I don't even know history. I just have a personal interest slash obsession with historical research and the past. And I always have. And so that's what drives my work. I love research and I love researching the past, and it helps me to learn a lot about the present. And it's just a fascinating place for me to go in my mind.
Well, tell us about how you became a historical novelist. What was your path to publication?
I was inspired after walking through historic Annapolis on a tour, and found they were telling us ghost stories along the way. So I thought, wouldn't that be interesting to write a ghost story, but set partially in Annapolis? And then a friend of mine had traveled to Nevis in the Caribbean and was telling me about the sugar plantations being abandoned and the connection in Maryland, the sad connection to slavery and to the movement of human beings and all of it. I started researching the past of Maryland slavery and then slavery in the Caribbean. And from that came the idea for this a gothic novel, essentially, that was a haunted house that took place in two time periods. And I really enjoyed writing the parts set in the past the most. The present day is fine for me, but I really love writing about the past, learning about what people wore, what they ate, how they behaved, why they behaved that way. And then that led me, you know, I'm always going on historic tours. So as I said, I went to the Hemingway House in Key West, which set off a research tangent. And Hemingway led me to Fitzgerald's, which set me on what was the Fitzgeralds like in Baltimore, where I essentially grew up half my life. And so it always just one thing leads to another that way.
Did you always want to be a writer?
Yes. I wrote my first play when I was 7. I've always journaled. I've written many short stories, articles, songs, all the way through. I wrote my first novel in middle school. It was terrible, but I had a wonderful teacher who encouraged me every step of the way. And just, I've always written. It's like a compulsion.
So at what point did you decide, I'm going to start publishing this?
Well, when I got through that self-published novel, I thought, oh gosh, everyone's going to want to read this. And I sent it to 100 literary agents and I got 100 rejections. Like, oh, nobody cares. But many of the rejections had to do with the fact that I didn't have a website. I had no reviews. I have no background. My background is in teaching, actually. And they just felt like it came from out of nowhere and they needed more of a writing publishing platform for me. And so I used that. I learned how to self-publish. Started going to book clubs, getting feedback, getting reviews, learning about the editorial process, and selling books and marketing. And it was really, really a rich and enjoyable process. And then by the time I wrote Hemingway's Girl, I knew a lot more. I had a bit of a platform. I was searchable. And I only queried 20 agents that time. And it was very, very specifically interested in the kind of books that I wanted to write. 3 of them asked to represent me, and I ended up with one who I'm still with to this day, Kevin Lyon at Marshall Lyon Literary. And so I learned a lot in the process.
Wow. So what was the title of that self-published book?
It's called Receive Me Falling. That's a line from a poem.
And is it still out there?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's out there. Yeah. And I also actually self-published a satire. My husband, we had gone through several years of travel hockey. And if you are a hockey parent or any sports parent at this stage, you understand it is a crazy, insane atmosphere. And my husband had written like all the terrible things we saw with parents, fist fights and drama. And he's like, you should write a novel about sports parents. And I said, no, I only write about the past. And I just thought, well, I'll try it. And 6 weeks later, I had a full draft of a manuscript and I ended up working with an editor, but I decided to self-publish that one too, because it's so different from my historical fiction branding as satire. That's called #HockeyStrong. And it's funny because a lot of times I'll go to book clubs and people say, well, I love your historical fiction, but that one really, his Hockey Strong really resonated with me because I'm a mom, or I'm a Boy Scout mom, or I'm a basketball dad, and the parents are crazy. And so that's where that went.
So when was that first book that you self-published? When was that?
That was in 2009.
2009. And when you got your first traditional, you know, mainstream publishing contract was how much later?
Well, Hemingway's, it was in 2010 that I signed a 2-book deal with Penguin, with New American Library. And that became Hemingway's Girl, which released in 2012, and Call Me Zelda was 2013.
Wow, you learned fast.
Oh, it was yeah. And then after that, Fallen Beauty, then the House of Hawthorne, and then moved into the Women in Intelligence and War novels.
Wow. And you've got, so the last one before the last assignment was The Last 12 Miles?
Yes.
And mm-hmm. what was that one about?
That was through all of my women, my current women in intelligence who I interview or had interviewed. I asked who was a really dynamite woman from the shadows of history. And one of them told me about Elizabeth Smith Freedman, who had learned during the Great War, who worked during Prohibition for the Coast Guard, and then also military for World War II. So I became obsessed with Elizabeth Smith Freedman. And I loved the Prohibition time period because I could have a little fun with it. And I found a female antagonist, a woman who was a rum runner, who was so colorful and fascinating. I couldn't have made her up. And they were great foils for each other. So that was the last 12 miles. And when you have to research in Key West, Prohibition and drinks, it's, you know, you can write that off. So that's all I'm saying.
All the mojitos. And yes. Okay. And Key West is quite a different place, isn't it?
Yes, it's very interesting.
Yeah,
and, I keep coming back to it. And even with Dickie here on the last assignment, when she got in with the anti-Castro guerrillas, they would launch from Key West or Miami Beach or.
Wow.
She was, and they would train in the mangroves of the Keys. So I keep coming back to it, which keeps leading me to research, and that delights me.
So, at the end of the last assignment, you have some author's notes, and in here you talk about some of the things that were fictionalized and some changes that you made in terms of what really happened in order to create a more coherent, cohesive storyline. So what were some of those things that you changed or fictionalized?
Well, it was really with this one, it was very hard because there were so many characters. So I had to have a condensed, I kept real people, but I needed them sometimes to be places where they weren't necessarily there. So for example, at the Hungarian border crossing, where she meets General Donovan, who was from World War II and the CIA, and was with a group of writers and correspondents, I had to always make it, you know, Jim Michener, Carl Hartman. That would change sometimes. There would be different configurations, but for the sake of story, I had to always just keep those people together. With Castro, with the Cuban Revolution, there was a young man who becomes really important in the work and on both sides of the struggle, sort of with her. And I wasn't able to necessarily prove that she had met him when she was pro-Castro, even though he fought in the Sierra Maestra with Castro. I was able to prove that they met after the fact, but I did put him in her vicinity at that time. So we had a character that we could get to know throughout the story. So that's mostly what I did. And whenever I do something like that, there were a group of young Marines who came up to Dickie to tell them that their dads served with her they were with her at Iwo Jima and they were in Vietnam. I had to change the month that happened for sake of story, but I note all of it in the author's note. That's where I put all of my crimes against history. But I'm a novelist, so I have
yes.
to make it work.
Yes,
story.
Yes. Now, throughout the novel, there's letters and diary entries,
yes.
radio, television show transcripts, and those you also fictionalized to some extent, correct?
Yes.
But they all were based on real documents, real recordings.
Yes. So much of what I read from her was her correspondence and listened to her interviews and her TV appearances and her radio spots. And I read her journals. And so while I didn't use the exact, because that would have been sort of a permissions nightmare. And again, I'm not a biographer. I just, whenever a place in the story where it would advance the story or would be helpful to have her voice come through in a letter to her aunt or to hear the transcript of what she might have sounded like on a TV show, I would include those. And they would also help to advance the story in terms of history and be a bridge between Hungary and Cuba or Cuba and Vietnam. And so it rose organically, but I felt like it worked pretty well. And then at the end, she was given a recorder, a voice recorder when she was in Vietnam. And so that's where the final section of the book I do in her voice in first person point of view with her speaking into the microphone in her combat tape recorder, which really let me crawl into her skin. I usually tend to write in third person omniscient or third person limited, but it was a joy to kind of be Dickie in those moments because her voice was so unique and so great. So it was fun to kind of crawl into her skin for those times.
You also in the author's notes, you mentioned that you created a Pinterest page.
Yes.
And tell me a little bit about that and how someone can find that.
When I'm writing my book, I use Pinterest as a vision board. I keep private boards. So anytime I come across an article, photograph, particularly if it was hard to find, or a newspapers.com, which is a great resource, by the way, for 20th century historical fiction writers, or anyone just looking to see what the past was like. Whenever I've come across something there, I clip it and I put it into Pinterest. And then right before the book comes out, I organize my boards into the time periods or the movements of the novels. So there's a Hungarian section, a Cuba section, Vietnam, her early life, her photographs. And I just link it up there and make it public. And it's been my my readers and my book clubs just love this because when they finish the book, they want to go Googling. And sometimes it's hard to find things. So I've already done the work. So I just give it to my readers. And of course, you can do more on your own, but I like to have that there as sort of an image board.
Okay. So I just logged into Pinterest. So how would I find you here?
So if you search my name,
okay,
you should be able to get, which I'm searching right along with you.
Okay.
You come to my Pinterest page. Okay. And so I'm looking at all of my boards locked and unlocked, but I've unlocked.
Okay.
Dicky selfie. She made a selfie of herself. That's the big featured picture. You click on that. And then it breaks you down. I inspired by Taylor Swift. I have Dickie in her eras. She was like a different person in every era. And then we have World War II, the post-war Europe. She traveled around with her husband at the time and really showed what happened after the war and these poor refugees trying to rebuild. But then there's also some of her friends. We get through the different revolutions. What I loved about this novel was coming up for air in New York in the 50s and 60s. It was very glamorous. She was always in the bars or in Peacock Alley or at the hotels or at Central Park. So those are kind of a break for the reader between combat zones because you need to come up for air. It all can be a little too much. So we come back up for air in New York, a little bit in D.C., so that's what you'll find there. I left out and highlighted Vietnamese Girl with Sword because that is a huge scene in the book. And you know, why Dickie didn't have her own children, she was like kind of a mother of everyone. She was very mothering to people and to the kids in the villages where she would go or fighting with the revolution, she would bond with them and be like everybody's auntie. So that scene is really important. And really for the children trying to create a world where they weren't stuck in the endless cycle was her goal. And it hasn't been realized. And I don't know if it ever will be, but it's worth trying.
Of course, one of the most dramatic parts of the book is the Hungarian prison.
Yes.
Yes. And did she write about that that experience?
Oh, yeah. She writes extensively about it in her memoir. So I highly recommend you read it. It goes in much more detail.
Wow. It was pretty horrific, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And just it gave her a view into prisoners of war and their treatment. And she carried that through to how she interpreted what she saw both in Cuba and then in Vietnam. And it informed what she was trying to show people.
So, Erica, what's next for you?
Well, I'm in the middle of what's probably been one of the hardest books I've ever had to write because it's another woman in intelligence history, another woman who was very good at her job. So she was under the radar. There isn't a lot. And so having to piece together her story is very difficult. I can't say too much about it, and it's still in progress. I don't have a contract for it yet. I'm still in the drafting stage, but I'm sticking with it. But I will tell you, it is set in Cuba, largely in the early 60s, and it was something that Dickie came across that was illuminated for me that I didn't know anything about, and it was one of these time periods and people in history where I'm like, how do people know about this?
Wow.
So, that's where I am again.
Now, do you, when you are on a subject, you've decided on a topic, on a subject, and you start researching, at what Yes. point do you start writing? Like, do you do like a huge amount of research before you ever start writing, or are you kind of going back and forth between the two?
I do usually about 6 months of research before I write a word. And then at that time, I pick the timeline and the area of focus and start writing. But then the research is ongoing. So, for instance, I had a scene set at an embassy, British embassy in Cuba in 1960. I had to know who was a musician who would have been in Cuba at that time. And so that, you know, that was like days of research into the musicians in Cuba who stayed, who left. So it just becomes an ongoing situation, but for the most part, like the bulk of the work and the themes and the planning is done over about a 6 month time period.
Okay. Have you ever started researching a subject, gotten a few months in, and then decided, nope, this isn't for me?
Oh yes, absolutely. There was there's an apartment in London, and it's where Mama Cass died from the Mamas and the Papas, and then another rocker died there. And then I researched the building and found out there were a series of deaths and hauntings there, which led me into the occult. And I was like, no. So I got to that point, and this stuff is in my brain for like 2 years at a time. I inhabit these worlds. I have to become these characters. And when it starts getting really dark, dark without redemption, I should say, then I feel like I need to back away. I can't carry that for 2 years. I don't want to know some of those things. So with that, I did it. In a less sinister way, I've stopped and started with East of Eden with, why am I blanking on the East of Eden author? Oh my gosh.
I am too. Okay. John Steinbeck.
Thank you. Oh my gosh. Boy, really, I'm eating my afternoon coffee. Steinbeck. So I've started a few times with him because he is on the periphery of really interesting things. But I found, I don't know if I can even say this, I don't like him. I don't like him as a man. I don't have sympathy for him that I need to. I don't identify with him in the way that I could write him well. And I think his family has a pretty good hold on his estate, so I don't want to ruffle any feathers. So for that reason, I backed away from him. So there's different reasons, and sometimes it takes months to understand that, but it usually becomes very clear.
Have there been other situations where you thought there was a story there, but it didn't take you long to figure out that it wasn't enough to hold a whole book?
Well, yeah. And at this point, Now that I've been writing about so much war, I need the stakes to be high. I can't have somebody staring at the window, drinking a cup of tea, ruminating on whatever. My attention span, both from my phone and Instagram reels, is shot, and I'm bored easily. So I need high stakes, heavy plot. Off we go.
Well, I think you had that with Dickie Chappelle. She was amazing. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I want to thank you for being with us today, Erica.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah, me too. And I really enjoyed the last assignment and learning about this fascinating woman in history who lived her life. And I want to close with a quote from her that is, "You can do anything you want to do. If you want to do it so badly, you'll give up everything else to do it." And that does seem to be the way that she lived her life.
Yes.
Well, thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you, Monica.